This is the third body we found this month. Our community's getting nervous. All signs point to a killer on the loose. A predator snatching lives with no mercy. Without government or police, what do we do? One of the most pressing questions asked of anarchists like myself is how anarchy intends to deal with, to put it bluntly, the bad people. You know what I mean? The criminals, serial killers, warlords, and rapists. The worst of the worst. For those not in the know, anarchism is the philosophy and practice that opposes all hierarchy and authority, along with their justifying dogmas, and proposes the unending pursuit of anarchy, a world without rule where autonomy, mutuality, and free association form the basis of our society. Such a definition clashes with the mainstream idea of anarchy as one of violent chaos, but such an idea comes from the faulty assumption that authority is necessary for social order. Anarchists seek to challenge that assumption and put forward a radical vision of what could be without the domination of authorities. For further explanation, you can check out my video on how anarchy works. Back to the question of bad people, you're going to get all sorts of answers to the question of how to deal with them from all sorts of self-identified anarchists, even answers that I wouldn't consider consistent with anarchy. You'll get responses that range from philosophical quibbles over defining badness, to attributing all badness to the system, to basically recreating the state and policing but slapping the anarchy label on it. So let's get into the question of bad people in a world without authority. We're going to explore the bad, the ugly, and maybe, just maybe, the good too. Stay tuned. They say if it bleeds, it leads, so it's no surprise that crime dominates the media landscape. From old-fashioned newspapers to online feeds, you'll find reports on the latest murder, drug bust, or robbery. True crime pages reach millions of people daily. TV shows dramatize the criminal underworld, either from the police or the criminal's point of view. The media thrives on the attention captured by crime. It's quick to dub rampant crime as anarchy, which of course demands the imposition of law and order to keep us safe. Because that's what we all crave, right? Safety, security, peace of mind. In the name of these things, we sacrifice our privacy and freedom. We take our laptops and electronics out of our bags. We move through spaces with omnipresent security cameras. We cross borders according to the power of the passport afforded to us by the fortune of our birth. The problem is that no matter how much we sacrifice, no matter how stringent our security protocols or harsh our laws and punishments, we're still no closer to the safety we seek. There will always be more to sacrifice in the name of necessity. The law varies across the world, as do crime rates, but whether your country is a hotspot or a haven, there are fundamental problems with the state's approach to justice. For one, most crimes, whether violent crimes or property crimes, go entirely unreported. In criminology, this is known as the dark figure of crime. For all the propaganda that fills the airwaves, the police are quite bad at dealing with even reported crime, so many people don't even bother. It's very difficult to get global statistics on this, but even in the incarceration capital of the world, it appears that very few serious crimes end with an arrest, let alone a conviction. Of those convictions, around 5% or more may be wrongful convictions. The rates are even worse when it comes to reports, arrests, and convictions for sexual assault. This is in a country with the most highly funded police in the world, yet they fail by their own measurements of success. And what a standard of success it is to consider a crime solved once you've sent a criminal to the school of crime we call prison, a place where people are treated like animals and thus behave in kind, just to be released back into the world with nothing done to alleviate the causes of crime in the first place. I wonder what happens next. And yet, despite this piss-poor performance, people still believe in the police. No matter how bad they are at their jobs, their myth proves more potent than their reality. People are comforted by the idea that there's this higher power that is fighting for them. The assumption being, of course, that the police are there to fight the bad guys. That those guns will never be turned on you. That those bad guys you fear will never seek the badge themselves. That your demographic won't be next. That falsified or withheld evidence, coerced or mistaken witnesses, and inadequate legal defense won't stand in the way of your freedom. That you'll never be locked up or worse in the name of law and order. The justice system not only fails to address the injustices within its purview, but also enables injustice. It might convict you for stealing a loaf of bread, But a capitalist can steal the future of the entire planet once they have the right paperwork. The state can limit your freedom of movement with a fresh piece of legislation. It'll throw you in prison and subject you to all manner of torture and abuse, but it's okay because it's legal torture and legal abuse. Still, pointing to the flaws of the current system is not an automatic win for anarchy. Criticism of the existing system doesn't make every alternative viable by default. There are more than two choices, and far be it from me to set up a false dichotomy. So how does anarchy deal with crime? It doesn't. The category of crime is a product of hierarchical social relations, specifically a legal order with the authority to categorize actions as either legal or illegal. Crime is defined as either an act which is prohibited by the laws of the state or any omission of an act mandated by the state where this act or omission is subject to punishment by the state. So the concept of crime isn't compatible with anarchy. That's okay. Anarchists are not concerned with violations against the state anyway. We are, however, concerned with harm and harm reduction. We are concerned with the harm of slavery, whether the state deems it legal or not. We are concerned with the harm of pollution, whether it's allowed by law or not. We are concerned with the harm of killing, whether it is considered lawful or unlawful. There is no authority in anarchy that can prohibit harm, but that doesn't mean that everything is permitted because there's no authority to permit harm either. Nothing is illegal and nothing is legal. In such an illegal environment, as anarchist Sean Wilber puts it, our focus will necessarily shift from questions of law and order to considerations of expectations and consequences. People will still seek to preempt and resolve conflicts and even develop norms and best practices with the knowledge that everyone is expected to be responsible for their own behavior, because how they choose to act with their freedom will face responses, positive and negative, from those who are equally free. As Wilber notes, whether people take the reduction of harm to be an ethical principle or simply a practical necessity of anarchic society, and ultimately, however they individually define harm, the individual concern to avoid harm to oneself is likely to lead to a general social concern with the avoidance of harm. People may practice mediation when conflicts unfold, or engage in transformative justice when harm has been committed. Mediation is a voluntary conflict resolution approach that involves a mediator without a personal stake in the outcome, getting involved in a dispute between individuals or groups to aid them in reaching a mutually satisfactory decision. Transformative justice is a holistic approach that seeks to acknowledge the connections between individual and systemic forms of harm, based on three core principles. 1. Protecting the victim and providing them with the space to heal. 2. Protecting the overall community and providing it with the space to heal and reflect. And 3. Working collaboratively with the harmful actor to identify what is necessary to prevent further harm. Transformative justice can't be rushed for the sake of peace. It can be exhausting or even endangering if not carefully practiced. It is not easy work, especially when complicated by popularity or privilege. And most importantly, it doesn't apply to every situation. We'll get into that more a bit later. I wish there was an easy answer, but there will never be a single, all-encompassing solution to every instance of harm forever. Thankfully, certain kinds of harm that may be prevalent today, like theft, may be greatly reduced thanks to people's needs being met in anarchy. Through social revolution, through breaking down prejudices and stigmas, restoring the commons and networks of care, and empowering people to control their own lives, we can address poverty, relative deprivation, lack of education, and many of the other roots of today's crime. Not to mention all the non-criminalized systemic harm that will become impossible to maintain in the absence of authority, like capitalist exploitation. Interpersonal prejudices might persist and must constantly be opposed, but without authority, the worst excesses of discrimination, such as in housing, can be far more easily addressed. We can further reduce harm through the development of consultative associations, groups that are formed around a shared interest in gathering and disseminating information to inform people's decisions. One such association may focus on developing food safety standards. Another may seek to gather data on local resource limits. Yet another may investigate instances of harm with no clear culprit to gather the facts of each case. But ultimately, no matter how socioeconomically just our world becomes, we'll still have to deal with harm. Because no system can entirely eliminate harm. We can do better than the law does because the law is a particularly flawed way of dealing with harm, way too inflexible for the messy complexities of reality and too rigid for the nuances of each specific case. But even if we make the world a better place for all and eliminate most causes of criminality, even if we counteract and deconstruct many of the harmful ideologies that exist today, we will still have to deal with some percentage of simply bad people. Defining bad people is an inherently flawed and subjective exercise. But if we have to use such an overly simplistic term, I'd say that from my perspective, bad person isn't a fixed identity, but a section on a spectrum of actions and ideologies that I consider actively harmful. A bad person is someone who consistently and deliberately harms others, ignores consent, refuses accountability, and upholds systems of domination. Those who derive pleasure from the death and suffering of others. Those who seize petty or grand positions of authority to dominate others with impunity. Those who use and abuse others, sexually or otherwise. Our social conditions play a major role in who people become. So by transforming our conditions, we can expect to reduce the number of bad people that emerge in our world. But despite our changes to the system reducing their prevalence, there may always be some fraction of the populace whose commitments to cruelty, domination, and manipulation are too deeply entrenched and immune to change. People like the mystery killer at the beginning of this video. In anarchist William Gillis's essay on bad people, he describes them as people who are not just merely passing through badness, but who have taken it in and bonded to it. The state cannot protect us from these people. It's a comforting fantasy, but it falls apart with the understanding that those same bad people we fear are likely to pursue those positions of power to extend their ability to harm. Rapists and serial killers who are protected by the badge or the office they hold. Many arguments have been made for ACAB, but I appreciate Gillis's argument that policing attracts rot. The role of the police is to preserve simplistic hierarchies and rules with violence, to maintain order. That is to say, to make the world legible to the simple-minded, and to exercise unrivaled brute force to make this so. If police are bureaucrats with guns, as David Graeber puts it, they are so both to serve our highest rulers, and because a great many more, in hunger for simplicity, allow issues of conflict and security to be offloaded upon a very small number of people who are almost uncheckable. The role of policing attracts, facilitates, and is best performed by pre-existing bad people. Any serious harm reduction strategy must seek to make authority impossible. In a world without authority, we have to deal with bad people ourselves. With that in mind, welcome to game theory. But not that game theory. Game theory is a field of study. A few months ago, I watched a video by Veritasium, which presented an approach to the famous prisoner's dilemma in a way that affirms a key component of the anarchist strategy for resisting bad people. I'll let Veritasium explain the premise and then summarize the full video. Link below.
So, let's play a game.
A banker with a chest full of gold coins invites you and another player to play against each other. You each get two choices. You can cooperate or you can defect. If you both cooperate, you each get three coins. If one of you cooperates but the other defects, then the one who defected gets five coins and the other gets nothing. And if you both defect, then you each get a coin. The goal of the game is simple, to get as many coins as you can.
So, what would you do?
Suppose your opponent cooperates, then you could also cooperate and get three coins. Or you could defect and get five coins instead. So you are better off defecting. But what if your opponent defects instead? Well, you could cooperate and get no coins, or you could defect and at least get one coin. So no matter what your opponent does, your best option is always to defect.
Now, if your opponent is also rational, they will reach the same conclusion and therefore also defect.
As a result, when you both act rationally, you both end up in the suboptimal situation getting one coin each when you could have gotten three instead.
The thing about a lot of problems is that they're not a single prisoner's dilemma.
Impalas see each other day after day, and the same situation keeps happening over and over again. So that changes the problem. Because instead of playing the prisoner's dilemma just once, you're now playing it many, many times. And if I defect now, then my opponent will know that I defected, and they can use that against me in the future. So, what is the best strategy in this repeated game?
The rest of the video is spent exploring the studies done by Robert Axelrod to find the best strategies for success in such a game. He ran tournaments that tested every strategy against every other strategy to see who would win overall. In the first tournament, each strategy played 200 rounds with every other strategy, and the simplest strategy, tit-for-tat, won. Tit-for-tat starts every game with cooperation and then mirrors its opponent's previous move. In addition to tit-for-tat, Axelrod found the strategies that were nice, meaning they sought cooperation and didn't defect first, tended to perform better than the nasty strategies, which defected first. But they weren't just nice. They were also retaliatory, meaning they punished defection quickly, forgiven, meaning they didn't hold a grudge, and clear, meaning predictable and understandable. In the second tournament, new strategies were submitted, but once again tit-for-tat won, and most top strategies were nice and forgiven. When Axelrod ran a simulation that mimicked natural selection, successful strategies, which were almost all nice, multiplied, while nasty ones faded over time. The nasty ones that didn't go entirely extinct plummeted in numbers. Tit-for-tat initially struggled in one of Axelrod's experiments when he attempted to account for the noise of real life, where mistakes and misunderstandings can happen. But a simple tweak to its strategy to make it slightly more forgiving enabled it to break the cycle of retaliation and perform much better. In other words, occasionally turning the other cheek can disrupt negative spirals. So, what does this have to do with anarchy? Here's where Gillis provides some additional insights, this time in his article, What's in a Slogan? In predominantly cooperative mixed strategy systems, some parasitic or predatory strategies may persist on the fringes. The bad people. But the most effective long-term strategies not only maintain cooperation and retaliate to harm against themselves, but also retaliate in cases of harm against others. In other words, radical solidarity. Of course, as Gillis points out, anthropologists didn't need fancy simulations to discover this reality. They just talked to people living in stateless societies. Anarchy is not merely a stateless society, but I believe we can expect similar or even more proactive strategies to arise. Remember those traits for success? They're nice, retaliatory, forgiven, and clear. Similarly, in anarchy, we can expect cooperation, rehabilitation, and clear expectations and consequences. It may be in our best interest in most cases to de-escalate conflict and explore other options, since acting recklessly may only create further harm, but sometimes we may decide to consciously cause harm in response to harm. As Wilbur put it, in those instances where the conscious use of harm to prevent further harm seems to be, in the specific context, the only option that appears open to us, presumably we will remain faithful enough to our analysis not to pretend that even necessity can authorize our actions. Like any other action in anarchy, self-defense can be neither legal nor illegal. Ultimately, as I said before, each act is taken of one's own responsibility. There is no law or authority or majority approval that can absolve you of that responsibility for your actions. Also, when I speak of inflicting consequences on bad people, I don't exclusively mean defensive force. One of the more underrated tools in our arsenal is the social boycott. In anarchy, as a consequence of free association, our society will be composed of a web of relations that can make such collective action a viable means of resistance. Even an organized minority that refuses to engage with anyone who supports a bad person has the capacity to exercise immense social pressure and thus create meaningful consequences. Bad people and their predatory strategies will remain on the fringes of anarchy for as long as we stand up for ourselves and those around us and leave no hierarchies left for them to climb. No more outsourcing our safety. It is all of our responsibility to ensure that white supremacists, former cops, wannabe cultists, and fundamentalist gangs are met with resistance at every step. We don't try to debate them out of their position. We don't give them an inch so they can take a mile. We don't beg them to see our humanity. We make their attempts to harm others as costly as possible, by every means available to us. Those who seek to reform for the better will be met with those willing to do that work. But for the fringe few who continue to hurt, torture, and kill others for the love of the game, we meet them with force when necessary. That includes the rapists and abusers. I'm not going to be self-censoring rape with grape or anything like that, so I'm pretty sure YouTube won't like this. Consider supporting the Patreon if you also despise the censorship and trivialization of important topics by YouTube's policies. I'm zeroing in on this particular category of bad people to make something very clear. To quote anarchist Lisa Kuta's Intimate Authoritarianism, abuse is not individual pathology. Abuse is not an unfortunate mistake. Abuse is the form that systematic oppression takes on an interpersonal level. It is an agent of patriarchy, ableism, capitalism, and white supremacy. It is intimate authoritarianism and must be resisted just as strongly as we endeavor to challenge authoritarianism on a structural level. Rape culture is a war against entire populations of people. Rapists and abusers relish domination. They get off on suppressing the agency of others. They are just as much ideological enemies as feds, fascists, and fundamentalists. And they must be resisted just as directly and consistently as we resist any other agents of oppression. This is why trying to rehabilitate them through an accountability process should not be the default response. Our time, energy, and resources are limited. As Gillis points out, you're not going to get the rapist or abuser to change their whole predatory motivation by making them read some feminist theory. They might just learn some new performative language to use while continuing to prey on their victims. Or years of effort get wasted on reforming a predator who may have had a terrible childhood, but never had any interest in change in the first place. Worse yet is when accountability processes are hijacked by the folks involved. Gillis describes cases where the perpetrator's friends use the process to protect the perpetrator and marginalize the survivor, or the mediator sought personal prestige, or everybody just wanted to restore the community by suppressing conflict, which eventually led to the survivor being expelled instead of the perpetrator. In her article, Activist Scenes Are No Safe Space for Women, activist Tamara K. Knopper describes cases where survivors of abuse in activist spaces were dismissed and shunned while their abuser continued to be supported. I agree with Lisa Kuta's position that, as with anti-fascist work, our priority must be on destroying the abuser's capacity to carry out harm, not their rehabilitation. Let me be clear, I know not all situations are cut and dry. Though extremely rare, false accusations do happen and should be taken seriously without being weaponized against survivors. Also, I know that in sexual situations, miscommunications happen. Otherwise, decent people can unintentionally cause harm. Not every instance of consent violation is necessarily driven by a dominative value system. Of course, such instances should still be addressed according to the wishes of the person affected, and such instances can be avoided with more education on enthusiastic consent. But these instances are a far cry from the ideologically driven actors who knowingly and repeatedly violate people because they're motivated by power and control. Don't get me wrong, bad people can change. I'm not taking rehabilitation off the table. But the people who genuinely change their values and behavior do so because they genuinely want to, not because they've been peer pressured into an accountability process. David Graeber once said, "Bullying is not just a relation between bully and victim. It's really a three-way relation between bully, victim, and everyone who refuses to do anything about the aggression." This dynamic also applies to other forms of abuse. In Anarchy in Its Pursuit, it is all of our responsibility to actively resist bullies, abusers, rapists, and authoritarians. In Anarchy in Its Pursuit, we keep us safe. We're not always going to get along with each other, but we have to reach a point where when push comes to shove, we have each other's backs. Many of us are unprepared for the level of responsibility and initiative that anarchy requires of us. The status quo breeds passivity and apathy. We're taught to obey, wait, and depend on others to act first, even when we are more intimately aware of the situation than any distant authority could ever be. But that's why social revolution must develop in us the power and drive to act on our own initiative, to stand up to all forms of authority and prejudice, and to make the world we seek so compelling that all but the most stubborn would be drawn to join our efforts. The status quo persists thanks in large part to the role of systemic inertia. It's entrenched and difficult to see beyond, so it persists. That's why we need to generate our own inertia. We need to create spaces and cultures where autonomy, solidarity, responsibility, and mutuality are second nature, where disagreement is honestly reflected through our approach to organizing so that it is easier to go against the grain. We need to build a critical mass of free people who make it so that free association and resistance to authority become the new normal. All this talk about resisting bad people might give you the impression that anarchy is just an endless struggle against endless threats. But before we spiral into despair, it's worth remembering that most people aren't bad people. In fact, one of the biggest lies propping up the status quo is this idea of our inherent wickedness. So let's take a step back and ask what most people are really like. I recently read Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. It's a great antidote to the steady stream of media that seeks to confirm our negativity bias. The mainstream narrative about human nature is so intensely misanthropic that there are people who genuinely believe that the Purge movies can be treated like an anthropological study, or that Lord of the Flies is an accurate reflection of how children would behave in times of crisis, even though a real-life version played out very differently. Both The Purge and Lord of the Flies are excellent contemporary examples of what Bregman calls veneer theory, the popular Hobbesian idea that civilization is a thin mask covering our true, savage instincts. In case you haven't heard of him, Thomas Hobbes was a philosopher from the 17th century who painted a very grim picture of life before the rise of states. He called it solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. The reality of our stateless history is far more interesting. It isn't the nightmare of Hobbes or the romantic picture of Rousseau. We still have a lot to learn, but from what we have learned so far, the popular caricature of the brutal, knuckle-dragging caveman is just an insulting smear on our ancestors. As I've explored on this channel before, human nature and our prehistoric past are far more varied and interesting than either simple narrative can appreciate. There's one apparent constant, though. Cooperation. For better and for worse. Even without looking to the past, we can see how people behave in times of crisis today. As activist Rebecca Solnit found in her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, it's when disaster strikes that our better natures are most often revealed. For the most part, people help each other. They organize. They share. Recent studies on the bystander effect theory found that in reality, across the several major cities they studied, bystanders nearly always intervene to help in emergencies. Imagine the level of social responsibility that we might observe in anarchy, where people have an even greater stake in the social order. Now, I'm not saying that people are perfect angels, but I don't think it should be controversial to say that most of us have a baseline decency, even though we live in a system that distorts that decency. This entire machine is structured in ways that replicate certain ideas and reinforce certain behaviors. It manufactures scarcity, bombards us with propaganda, and incentivizes exploitation. The system doesn't determine all of our behavior. People can still cooperate to distribute free breakfasts and resist injustice. But like I said, our cooperative nature can manifest for better and for worse. People can also cooperate to violently maintain racial hierarchy through lynchings. The system has its ideological diehards, the truly locked-in bad people, but that's not where it gets all of its support. A sense of camaraderie, the material benefits of privilege, the pressure to conform among the in-group, and the psychological and or physical distancing of certain out-groups are the factors which keep this oppressive system going. Those are also, coincidentally, the factors that foment genocide. It's how an otherwise decent humanity can cooperate to do some horrifyingly atrocious things. It's why as anarchists, wherever we find ourselves, it's our responsibility to interrupt these factors. We can't settle for merely opposing the overt acts of authority. We must challenge even the subtle naturalization of hierarchy at home, at school, at work, and throughout society. And we must build the conditions where our values can flourish. So, can anarchy protect us from bad people? Anarchy doesn't promise a perfect world. It doesn't offer a final solution to every act of harm and cruelty. But it does offer a better starting point. One that refuses to defer to authority, outsource responsibility, appease abusers, or hand bullies a badge and call it justice. Instead, it requires each of us to recognize our role in opposing domination, developing solidarity, and cultivating responsibility, especially when things get tough, messy, and personal. My answers are not going to be satisfying enough for everybody. Perhaps I was too vague or too considerate of the unique context of each situation. Perhaps it's my refusal to sweep our world's complex and messy problems under the oppressive rug of the state. Perhaps I didn't entertain your desire for anarcho law and order. Perhaps it's because I didn't automatically defer to rehabilitation. Perhaps my lack of pacifism in the face of abusers has made you uncomfortable. Perhaps you consider my assertion of human decency hopelessly naive. That's okay. I'm trying to be real about what we're up against and what it takes to build something different. If the kind of world I want to help build even partially interests you, all I ask is that whoever you are, And wherever you are, do whatever you can. Talk to your people. Challenge harm. Build trust. And never forget, we keep us safe. All power to all the people. Peace. Thanks for watching. Please like, comment, subscribe, and share with fellow peoples. Thanks to the seedlings, the saplings, and especially the roots for making all this possible. Including our newest member, Abhinav Ramachandran. You can join these beautiful humans and support me too on patreon.com/sainttrue. Check out my other videos for a range of radical topics. Thanks again. Peace.